Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Author Julia Gordon Bramer is a cross between Greg Braden, who brings spirituality to science, and Jen Sincero, who brings spirituality to being a badass. With personality, clarity, and wit, this author, poet, scholar, and professional tarot card reader has spent the last decade and a half interpreting Sylvia Plath's work through mysticism. Gordon Bramer is listed in St. Louis's top 10 psychics by Psychic St. Louis and is called St. Louis's number one fortune teller by CBS. She is an ordained minister with the Universal Life Church, Ho'oponopono certified, and a member of the American Tarot Association. An accomplished creative writer and poet, Gordon Bramer was called St. Louis's best local poet in 2013 by the Riverfront Times. She is the author of Tarot Life Lessons, Living Wisdom from the Major Arcana, out in 2023 from Destiny Books, and The Occult Sylvia Plath, The Hidden Spiritual Life of the Visionary Poet, out May 2024, also from Destiny Books. She's seeking publication for Night Times, a memoir of Gordon Bramer's years running a music magazine in the 1990s alternative rock scene in St. Louis. Formerly an adjunct professor, she has taught for both St. Louis Community College and Lindenwood University's graduate creative writing program in St. Louis, Missouri. Julia Gordon Bramer, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi.
I can't wait to talk about some of the things in that bio.
But yeah, it's a long one. When you get to be 60 years old, there's a lot to say.
Exactly. But our first question for everybody, and given all of the things that you do, maybe this is especially poignant for you, is why write? Why still write books?
Oh my gosh, because it's what I do. I mean, it's what I've done since I was 6 years old. And as you mentioned there, I'm also a poet. You know, writing is just a part of me. So whether it's poetry or fiction or nonfiction or letters, which is a kind of an art that's often getting lost now, but that's important to me as well. I just can't help myself.
I mean, I think that's true for so many of us that it's just, you know, we get loopy if we don't. Like, it's just what we have to do to be functional humans.
how we express,
Mm-hmm. So, one of the things, so I read The Occult Sylvia Plath. That was the book that the lovely Manzanita at Destiny sent me. And I'm obviously, you're a poet. So, I mean, there seems like there's a natural, you know, interest in Sylvia Plath, but why Sylvia Plath in particular? I mean, you've dedicated a lot of time to her.
Yeah. Almost two decades now. And maybe more, you know, if I consider the time I just appreciated her as a fan, but as a scholar, a couple of decades. You know, why? I found her when I was 16. I found the Bell Jar. And that's how most people find her, through her novel, her heavily autobiographical novel, which is very tragic and sad. That wasn't what really got me. You know, at the back of my copy of the Bell Jar, behind this story, was a little summary, I guess you could say, of her life. And it had a poem in it that she wrote when she was 19 years old called Mad Girl's Love Song. And that poem entranced me for my whole life, which is so crazy because it's not even in the collected poems of Sylvia Plath. It was, they matched it up to the Bell Jar. I believe Lewis McNeese was, or maybe it was someone else. But anyway, whoever wrote that little mini biography on her following the Bell Jar had matched that poem because she had written it around the same time that she had gone through all the events that happened in the Bell Jar, which is basically a story of her, of Plath and her depression and falling apart when she had a job at Mademoiselle magazine, and sort of her life in New York and the great highs and the terrible lows, and how it all ended in a nervous breakdown. And yeah, so I don't know. I got sort of, you know, mesmerized by the whole thing. Didn't think all that much about it, except that Plath kept coming up for me in my studies, you know, in high school and in community college, in real college, in in my graduate course. And the more I learned about her, I did know we had some weird synchronicities. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, I guess it starts with me being born 9 months after she died in 1963. That isn't any big thing all by itself. But then there's other weird things. My grandmother's name was Sylvia. My mother's British and moved to America, married an American man and stayed in America. And she was American and moved to Britain and married a Brit and stayed in Britain. And my grandfather died when I was 8. Her father died when she was 8. Both of them lost their left legs, kind of curious little, you know, mm-hmm. It starts to get to be what I call the Lincoln Kennedy coincidence. Like,
oh,
I have,
yeah.
That.
Yeah.
I have that with Sylvia Plath. So, you know, I don't, it's just for me to be sort of, you know, playful and interesting. I don't take that so seriously. I'm not saying I'm reincarnated. In fact, I truly believe I am not reincarnated. But I do believe she's been helping me in this work. Mm-hmm. I can talk to you more about. But, you know, it all kind of came to a head in graduate school. And in graduate school, I was looking for a semester end project and not coming up with a whole lot. And I had pointed out to my professor that there was a lot of tarot symbolism that I saw in Plath's poetry. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, oh yeah, look here, you know, and I'm showing him what the cards are and what, and he's like mind blown, you know, and he said, make that your semester end project. And that really became my life's work. So mm-hmm. I identified in graduate school that Ariel, as she had intended it to be published, you know, it was rearranged when it was first published posthumously. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, Plath and Hughes's daughter, Frieda Hughes, published it as her mother had intended. And that's when it just opened up to me, because I could see the tarot correspondence and how each poem, you know, the first poem, Morning Song, equals the, you know, the Fool card, and, mm-hmm. and the Couriers equals the Magician. And it just went, you know, in correspondences, I could see the pictures of the cards within the poems. I could see all the meanings woven in. And I realized in that moment that Plath has been completely misinterpreted and read only for her drama and her autobiography. Mm-hmm. And that's there, but it's so much more than that, you know?
Yeah.
And so it just kind of became my life's work to redeem her for her genius, you know, get away from the drama.
Yeah, I've always kind of had a chip on my shoulder about, I feel like people do kind of pigeonhole Plath as like the domain of like moody teenage girls, which pisses me off, because I think, like you said, she's so much more than that. And, you know, yes, her life was tragic and short, but that doesn't take away from her brilliance, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. I think she was truly a genius's genius. I mean, in my first book, Fixed Stars Govern a Life, Decoding Sylvia Plath, which is now out of print, that was published through Stephen F. Austin State University. And I do sell PDFs of that for just $5. But in that book, I have, I show how each poem has at least 6 different meanings. So she takes one set of words and can make it read 6 different ways. And she did that 40 times, mm-hmm. you know, in Ariel. And I had a Harvard mathematician do the calculation for what the chances are of that to be coincidental. And it's not possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one in a gigillion or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it just is not possible. She knew what she was doing. And so to fast forward to the current book, The Occult Sylvia Plath, this was going to be the introduction to the very first book I published, Fixed Stars Govern a Life, but it just took on a life of its own. But this is all the supporting information, all the evidence that that I've found in the archives and everywhere, and even in other biographies and memoirs and letters that all prove that she knew what she was doing here, and that this was a very conscious construction, you know, mystical construction.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about a little bit in that book, and I think on your website as well, about how like a lot of those biographies of her and discussions of her have either purposely or by happenstance, but maybe more purposely, kind of elided the supernatural, I guess the mystical elements of life and experience.
You know, academia is notoriously atheist. And Plath herself, she called herself an atheist. I think, sure, in a way, you know, and she certainly wasn't avowing a traditional God in the throne in the sky, that paternalistic, you know, she wasn't that at all. But she also called herself pagan, I don't know how many times. And she was truly the most spiritual atheist you've ever come across. I mean, she practiced with Ouija boards regularly and her tarot deck and crystal ball, which she's photographed with on the cover. That's actually a picture of her on my cover, you know, and it goes on and on. I mean, she was into, you know, bibliomancy. It's all recorded, you know, just really daily practices since she was a child. And most people don't know about her childhood, how she grew up. She was in the Unitarian Church. She had Sunday school homework studying the zodiac, you know? And she had a mother who got her master's degree studying Paracelsus, the famous alchemist. And her father was a Freemason. And, you know, I mean, it's just like so much influence that shaped her on this mystical path.
Yeah.
And for the academics to poo-poo it, I mean, it just seems like they're leaving out such a huge part of the story. And, you know, and I think it's because they don't get it. Mm-hmm. And I think that my book will help people to understand what some of these symbols are that they're seeing. But, you know, Plath and her husband, Ted Hughes, they were very smart. I mean, they didn't hide things so much because no one knows what alchemy is in general. I mean, there's a reason. The occult, the word occult means hidden. It's hidden from the masses. The masses don't get it. So you have to kind of have a trained eye to understand some of these things were rituals that they were doing, and some of these things were special orderings, and they all had important symbols that they were including. And it's just completely missed the academic world entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you said about it, you know, the occult being hidden is important. And you comment several times in the book about how Ted Hughes, especially early on, was more open about what they were doing. And then as he got more notoriety, got quieter about it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Ted Hughes, you know, he didn't really play by the rules. I mean, he was definitely a rebel. He was a rebel in school, and he never cared all that much about being famous until Plath made him famous. You know, she acted as his secretary and his agent and sent everything out. And then he did, you know, he had a lot of superstitions about, you know, he took the Eastern kind of belief on shouldn't be photographed that much, and that it can capture elements of your soul and people can get into your spirit and your energy. So, you know, he tried to withdraw from some of that. Keep in mind, witchcraft had only been, it had been taken off the books in England as a crime in 1953. And Hughes were married in 1956. And so, you know, they didn't want that kind of tarnishing their reputation. It wasn't something they would advertise. Plus, Plath had a history of mental illness. She'd been institutionalized and had shock therapy and a suicide attempt that everyone knew about. She In her writings, it appears she had more than one. But she, you know, was definitely fragile and trying very hard to present herself as someone who was serious mm-hmm. and had her act together. Yeah. And so she didn't want the crazy reputation.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. And I mean, I think one of the things that I thought you handled so beautifully in your book about her, you know, her father dying when she was so young and kind of how she was so removed from that by her family and didn't really get to grieve and didn't have any kind of closure or anything of that. And I don't think, you know, from this remove, we can go, that's why she was like she was. I mean, that's not, you know, I guess armchair psychiatry or whatever. But but I do think it explains something. And it was, you just handled it really well. It's like, of course, this would be difficult for a child, you know, mm-hmm. to lose a beloved parent, even one that was very Prussian in his approach to right. their relationship. But, you know, to lose her beloved father in this really unexplained, unexamined, not talked about, you don't get to go to the funeral, you know, this way, like, of course, that would be damaging to a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how interesting the same thing happened to her own children later when mm-hmm. she, you know, it's yeah. strange how history repeats itself. And yeah. her son, Nicholas, committed suicide, you know, mm-hmm. terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. I mean, and in some ways, I think her father did too, out of his stubbornness.
Yeah.
yeah. Just because, yeah, sure. yeah, because he just refused. I mean, what one of the doctors was like, how can you be this smart and be so stupid about your health?
Yes. Exactly.
But yeah, I was like, oh, well, unfortunately, a lot of brilliant people are like that.
And I hope I gave a fair story to everyone, because even Otto Plath, I mean, what a tragic story he had, coming across the ocean liner as a boy of 15, all by himself, mm-hmm. abandoned by his parents, you know, and just removed from everything, you know, yeah. to go start in life in this new world, brilliant beyond, you know, anybody's wildest expectations. The German, you know, culturism, I guess you could call it, it's not exactly racism, but, you know, with World War I and everything being so anti-German and against him and an FBI mm-hmm. file on him and, you yeah. know, as a potential enemy. Crazy stuff and yeah. not easy to live with. And one failed marriage before, mm-hmm. or Platt's mother. And so, you know, I tried to show the humanity, you know, that's something I can do at 60 years old that maybe I wasn't capable of at 30 when I probably had made my assumptions about who people are. And when you're a grown up, you know, and you can look over their lives and you can see all of it and you can really see their humanity and that very few yeah. people are all evil. And, you know, people have read Plath's poem, Daddy, and so they hate Otto, and they've read, you know, Plath's poem, Medusa, and so they hate Aurelia, her mother, and, mm-hmm. you know, a couple journal entries where she wrote, I hate my mother. And they've blanketed that over the whole relationship. And
right.
life's so much more complex than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny you say that, looking back, being able to look at someone else's life with some distance and clarity. And I mean, I'm in my 50s too. And I think it, you know, it does give you some remove. And I think I also kind of projected some of that synchronicity stuff on Sylvia and her relationship with her dad. My great grandfather also came to the United States when he was like 16 with his younger brother, Otto. He was like 15 and, you know, moved to Chicago and was a meat cutter and then died of appendicitis when he was 32 and his wife was pregnant, you know, like, so it was, you know, this kind of that same, like, these were real lives, you know, these people had real lives and
yeah,
you know, it's mm-hmm. not, it's not something that can be captured in two lines from a poem and a journal, a whole relationship.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like you and I have a similar background, because my grandfather also came over from Czechoslovakia and Trenck's Vulva, which is another kind of close to Platt's Frank Schober in a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, that same South Side Chicago, that's where my dad's roots are. So that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just funny to me how things all link up. And I mean, it's funny you say that you don't think you're Sylvia Plath incarnated. I was joking the other day, and I can't remember in the context now, but one of my Roman empires, I guess, is the martyrdom of Hypatia.
Oh.
And I was joking about, like, I don't think I'm Hypatia reincarnated or anything. And I was like, hopefully that woman still has rest. Hopefully Sylvia is still resting.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. She needs it.
Yeah. I was like, I would want them to have a longer break. But yeah, it's funny to me that, you know, like when people talk about past lives, there is this trope that, you know, everyone was famous. And I'm like, we can't all be Cleopatra.
That's so, for sure.
Yeah. Or Sylvia Plath, whatever the case may be. So how do you think this 20-year odyssey with Plath has affected your own work?
Oh, well, it certainly has. I mean, one of the things it taught me was just that system of structure, which I'll come right out and say I am incapable of doing anything like what she did. Never have I gotten one poem to have six different meanings. I've gotten them to have a few, but not with the grace that Plath did. So, but it taught me to see it, and it taught me to arrange my own work this way. And that's both poetry and fiction and nonfiction. It all has the elements of the Kabbalah tree of life, which the tarot is based on. And I structure everything that way. And this book is that way. And tarot life lessons is that way. And my poetry is that way, although I have not published a book of poetry yet. I mean, even some book reviews and things I've written with that kind of understanding. What it is really, the Kabbalah tree of life, it's kind of like a template for the human story. And so if you think of, if you're familiar with the tarot's major arcana, which I'm guessing you probably are, we're looking at, you know, the mythic journey, the journey of individuation, as Carl Jung would call it. The hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell called it. And we all have it, and we all feel it, and we all have these events that happen. And so to incorporate this, to weave it into the work, it gives a feeling of completion, honestly. Mm-hmm. So Plath did it brilliantly, and like no other, I think she did it better than Ted Hughes. My working title for The Occult Sylvia Plath was going to be The Magician's Girl. That's what I pitched it to in her tradition. And The Magician's Girl is a line from her poem, The Bee Meeting, where she says, I am the magician's girl. I do not flinch. And you know, the reason I had picked that line was because Ted Hughes mentored her. And he taught her everything he knew. And the two of them together perfected it, you know. Mm-hmm. And they both became quite famous you know, through this system. It's just, you know, it's interesting. I have gone all through Ted Hughes's work, and he's done it in everything. He did it much more loosely than Plath did. He would start at different points on the Kabbalah tree of life and go backwards and forwards and things like that. Whereas Plath had that strict, as Ted Hughes would say, Germanic structure of, you know, it be perfect.
Yeah.
Always perfect.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking about, you know, like Ted Hughes and people who protested him when he came to the United States, and like just when, you know, after Ariel came out and people kind of took her up as a cause for feminism and him as the great devil of feminism, I guess. Like I get it on some level, but also I think part of it feels like it undermines her agency in her own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For him to be the root of, you know, her highs and lows only. Like, yeah. She was her own person too.
Right. She's become a martyr. She's become a victim, and, you know, the sacrifice, and just sad because she was powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not, you know, maybe not well-balanced, you know, I think there's, I'm no doctor, but I think there's a really good chance she was bipolar and, mm-hmm. and not medicated. But she was brilliant beyond, you know, so many writers and that's overlooked. And, you know, it's kind of sad and frustrating when you see that, like, Gwyneth Paltrow stars as her in that movie Sylvia in the early 2000s. I don't know if you saw it. And Daniel Craig is Ted Hughes. And they're both gorgeous, of course, mm-hmm. as Sylvia and Ted were both gorgeous. But it's only about the drama. It's only yeah. about his philandering and her depression. And it's like, oh, God, let's show why we're still reading her today. Yeah. Let's understand that, you know, this mm-hmm. that there's a reason these words resonate. And these are actual spells that we are being enchanted by. You know, words have power, even in the Bible. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word yeah. was with God, and the Word was God. You know, that's the magic right yeah. there. And she and Ted knew how to use it.
Yeah. I mean, Ted has perhaps earned some of his...
He was
Barbs.
Great.
He is a bit of a philanderer. I mean, there's no way around that. But, you know, and I think, you know, but his life is tragic in its own way.
It is. He got his karma. You know, mm-hmm. he paid pretty dearly for being that jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to have your wife, your mistress, you know, your son taken from you in the way that they were, that's pretty horrific.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think it's interesting. He sort of fell in love with Sylvia again after her death and mm-hmm. with her ghost. It seems to me like he, after his mistress died, you know, it seems that he was not able to love again. Mm-hmm. And he was just running through women. That's how it seems.
Yeah.
And, you know, marrying Carol Orchard, I think that was pretty convenient. For those who don't know the story of Asha Wevel, the mistress, she basically destroyed Plath and Hughes's marriage. And then he wasn't so good to her either. And she had a baby girl with Ted, and she died the same way Sylvia did and took the little girl with her and mm-hmm. Made him pay, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty ugly.
Pretty ugly stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I just think he was kind of broken after that. And mm-hmm. I don't think he was ever maybe really capable of love. With Sylvia, he was enchanted by her and he was impressed by her and he, you know, loved her brilliance. She was one of the few people who could match him mm-hmm. in brilliance. And I think that really blew him away. But at the end of the day, you know, he couldn't be faithful. And I'm not sure there would be anyone in the world he could be faithful to. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's like, it's easier to look at it with some perspective. Mm-hmm. Probably than at the time even, but yeah, I mean, I kind of hate that he's become the agent of her life instead of her, and I think it just I find yeah. it kind of achy
to the but. Point that he rearranged Ariel, mm-hmm. you know, when her book of poems first came out, he removed the ones that were that cast him in the worst light, and mm-hmm. and you know. And he still did. It's interesting. He still did it in a Kabbalah structure, but mm-hmm. it just wasn't quite as good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he controlled the estate for so long.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. But I also want to make sure we talk about your work with the tarot because
oh, yeah.
your book's they've come out pretty close together, actually. You had two books kind of come out back to back. But I mean, I assume all of this has impacted your work as a tarot some, but let's talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. So Tarot Life Lessons came out 6 months before The Occult Sylvia Plath. It came out in November of last year, 2023. And it is my real life stories as a professional tarot card reader. I have been reading tarot cards myself for over 45 years. And I have been professional since around 2010. Mm-hmm. And so I've got some interesting stories, and I had just jotted them down so I wouldn't forget, because mm-hmm. some of them blew me away. And then over COVID, I thought, maybe I'll just make a book of it. My husband, actually, it was his idea, because he's heard a lot of the stories. And so I threw them all together during COVID, and that working title was The Tarot Diaries. Mm-hmm. And it got snapped up by Inner Traditions, which Destiny Books is their subsidiary that's published mm-hmm. both of my books. You know, I thought 6 months apart would be plenty of time to release two books, and I'll never do that again, because, oh my goodness, the work in releasing a book and promoting it and recording the audiobooks, and it's very, very time consuming, and it's really been a chore. So I think one book a year from now on.
Yeah. Did you do the audiobooks yourself?
I did. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. It was funny when they approached me to do an audiobook for Tarot Life Lessons. Well, first they said they wanted to do an audiobook, and they said, "And here are the people we have in mind, and you pick which voice you like." And I was like, "What?" Like, these are my words, you know. Nobody can have my words but me. And I listened for like a half a second to the people, and I'm like, no. I have to do it. And it was hard. It was a lot harder than I thought, because you really have to act, you know. Mm-hmm. You have to put on voices. It's not just reading out loud. You have to really, you know, be in the part. But I had fun with it, and I got used to it. And the other hard things, my gosh, you know, microphones are sensitive, and my stomach would rumble, or, you know, or a car would go by outside, or an airplane overhead. Yeah. And I don't have a soundproof studio. I have a pretty good, you know, almost not quite soundproof, but, you know, sound muffling studio. So I had some challenges, but we got them both done, and I'm very pleased. I have not yet heard the audiobook to The Occult Sylvia Plath. While we're talking, that has not yet been released. But I'm real pleased with my Tarot Life Lessons audiobook. I think they did a fantastic job. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny, like, just how much I had to learn about audio for the podcast, and it's a lot more forgiving than the audio standards for audiobooks are really high.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's probably something that people don't know unless they're kind of in the industry or really into geeking out about stuff like that. But yeah, the thresholds and the sound dampening, and it's really more complicated for an audiobook.
Yeah, just how you say things. I mean, mm-hmm. we talk different from day to day. Sometimes mm-hmm. my voice is more full than other days. Or sometimes, you know, I may read with a certain kind of cadence and expression, and then if I go back to fix something, it sounds different. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's crazy making to try and get it all right. But it's been an experience, and I'll do it again, probably, you know, in a future book. I like doing it, and I'd much rather be the one reading my words than someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like, especially for nonfiction, I really do like when the author reads. I mean, mm-hmm. fiction, you know, like, I have toyed with the idea of reading my own books, but I don't do voices very well.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, I can kind of see for fiction, like, I would want someone else to read that. But for nonfiction, it really is a more direct experience with the author.
Yeah. I have audiobooks by Brené Brown, if you know her, and mm-hmm. I love her, but I can't, there's one that's not in her voice, and it's like, nah, I can't even, I want to hear her.
Yeah. And I've listened to several, like, occult witchy books that other publishers have done that they have other people read. And I often go, well, that's not what I imagine they would sound like. You know, it's like the information is great, but there is something lost a little bit when you realize it's not who's reading the book to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for you, like what role does tarot play aside from obviously your vocation at this point? Mm-hmm. Like what role does tarot play in your life?
Oh, it's every day. You know, I try not to make my life depend on it because tarot card readers know that we project a lot onto the cards. And so, you know, it's best to sort of have a cold reading where you're not biased one way or the other, because if you're afraid of something happening or if you're wanting something to happen, the cards can kind of mess with you that way. And so we need to not care, you know. But if I'm just, you know, I mean, my cards are right here beside me and I've probably thrown them down two or three times today, just wondering like, you know, okay, what's going on with so-and-so? What are they feeling about me? Mm-hmm. Or you know, yeah. Something like that. I obviously I'm a very busy reader, as it's my full-time profession. Mm-hmm. I have jobs booked around this interview and I'll be, you know, back on, and I do some video, I do some just phone. I do even email tarot readings. Some people like that kind of anonymity. And they just are okay with throwing a few questions at me and not having like a full session, you know, that's email readings are generally shorter like that. But it's just a part of my everyday life. It always has been. It is the best way that I access my psychic abilities. I am learning all the terms. I mean, back when I was coming up, these terms didn't exist. Like I didn't know that I was empathic, for instance, mm-hmm. until that word probably started coming around the early 2000s, you know, being an empath. I didn't know I was clairaudient. Although I would have just said, okay, you know, well, I hear things, you know, mm-hmm. and there's been a lot of jokes about that, you know, like, oh, she's crazy, you know, mm-hmm. but it is often even audible or almost audible. And that works with the cards, you know, just feelings, those gut feelings. I found, you know, I started having my first premonitions around the same time I got my first tarot deck, around age 16, which oddly is the time I found Sylvia Plath too. Mm-hmm. And if it all ties together, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you did mention earlier, and I meant to get back to it, about they felt like Sylvia's kind of been with you on this journey to study her. So you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, it just sort of unfolded, you know, mainly since graduate school, which I started graduate school in 2007. And when I was working on this project, and you know, it was so interesting because I always said if I knew what I was getting into and the amount of work and, you know, the expense of traveling up to the Plath archives all the time and all of the literature I would be buying and, you know, and all of that, I mean, this is a lot. It would have been easy to scare me away from it. Oh, not to mention the ostracism from the academic community. I mean, mm-hmm. they have been horrible to me. I've been iced out of conferences and removed from websites and, you know, and because I don't follow their, you know, way of thinking. Mm-hmm. Where was I going with this? Sylvia, I have just had signs throughout. When I was in the middle of, you know, what I call decoding the Ariel book, when I was writing the first book, Fixed Stars Govern a Life, decoding Sylvia Plath, and I was at the 14th poem, which aligns with the Temperance card, which is the title poem Ariel. And as I was pulling this apart, I discovered that there were all these images in the same order, very close to a prayer that Aleister Crowley wrote. Sorry, Crowley, got to get the pronunciation right. We Americans tend to say it wrong. That Aleister Crowley wrote, and it was basically a prayer to the great beast 666. And I was like, huh? And I thought, that's it. I don't even want to go there. I am, you know, I have this Christian background. I am so not about the dark stuff. And I didn't want to continue. And I went to bed that night. And as I was drifting off to sleep, I heard Platt's voice very loud in my ear. I know her voice because I've heard countless recordings. And she said, move through. And I was like, you know, just shocked awake. And I thought, okay, I'll do one more poem. Well, then I got it. Poem number 15 aligns with the devil card. And she was basically introducing the devil card. And so that was kind of the first sign. When I was in the archives, I was in a hotel room up in Bloomington, Indiana, doing my work. And I had been spending a lot of time in Platt's childhood journals. And I was recording everything that she read and watched on, well, she didn't watch TV back then, it didn't exist, but listened to the radio and movies she saw and, you know, all her sort of cultural influences. I wanted to keep a journal of all of that to show, you know, some of that she knew stuff, basically, that I was claiming. And, you know, reading childhood diaries are not quite as exciting as reading adult diaries. When you're reading a 9-year-old and she's talking about what she ate at summer camp and, you know, and all of this stuff. And I was getting a little bored, honestly. And I was in my hotel room and I said aloud, not even really thinking, I said, and I had the TV on, and I said, Sylvia, am I supposed to keep reading 1945? Or can I just blow ahead to when you grew up? And on the TV, I hear 1945. And I look, and it's some sort of World War II movie that they're showing a commercial. Yeah. And I was like, okay. So I went back to the archives, finished the 1945 journals, found a bunch of valuable things that I would have just glossed over because I was getting. So there was that. And then the ultimate thing was in 2021, where I was contacted by Dr. Richard Larshan, who texted me this morning, actually. And he was a friend of the Plath families. He was very close to Aurelia Plath. He did not know Sylvia herself, but he knew Warren, her brother. And he did a lot for Aurelia. And he was gifted a lot of possessions that Sylvia's. And one of the things that he had that he wanted me to have, because I understand the mystic aspect of Sylvia, is a hand-carved hermetic caduceus, basically a magic wand with alchemical symbols, plus her initials SP at the base of it. And it's mine. And I never would have dreamed of owning such a possession. But I feel very chosen, you know. It's funny because there was that big Bonhams auction in 2020, and her tarot cards, which she did not make herself, you know, this they were purchased, they sold for over $200,000. So I can only imagine what the value of this is. It's kept in a safe, of course. But I had tried to buy things at that auction and I couldn't afford, you know, just smallest little trinket. And then to think that I was chosen to be the owner of this, you know, if that's not confirmation. And then Dr. Larshan has also sent me, I have on my desk, I have a little picture of her from high school that her mother Aurelia wrote on the back. You know how you get all those many, many pictures and, you know, just cute 1950s Plath. And I have a copy of her neighbor, Trevor Thomas, wrote his own memoir about her death. And he sent it to Aurelia and there's his inscription and all that. Aurelia got upset about the whole memoir and she didn't want her name on it. And she snipped it out. And I have that exact copy that Aurelia gave Dr. Larshan.
Oh, wow.
So I have some fun stuff, fun for a Plath scholar. Mm-hmm. I have some of her hair that one of the museum curators gave me, just a little snippet of her hair.
Oh, wow. Yeah. She has been with you in the flesh and in spirit.
Yeah, truly.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's so funny to me, like, you know, saying kind of you've been pushed out of academia about it. Like, I feel like I've talked to a lot of kind of academic folks on the show who do work outside academia.
Yeah.
And some have also worked inside academia, but a lot of them work outside academia. And I just feel like academia is missing out.
Oh, well, you know, the PhDs are basically a program to say, here is how to think. And there is only one way to think. Mm-hmm. And they're missing all the other influences and new material. And it's just a very narrow tunnel vision kind of view. Yeah. I was talking to an archaeologist about the Egyptian pyramids, or actually specifically the Sphinx. And there's this whole kind of subculture of archaeologists who understand that the Egyptian Sphinx is like 2,000 years older than anybody says it is. Mm-hmm. But no one will accept it. And they've got all of this evidence, you know, but mm-hmm. but the academics are like, nope, it's been decided. It's X number of years old. That's the story. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. It's not education anymore. It's a programming, you know?
I mean, I do feel like there are some gaps that have opened, because I think about like Dr. Ronald Hutton and how, you know, he still teaches at Gresham College, I believe, but, you know, is very much involved in, you know, attends conferences that are occult conferences, not academic conferences. Like, he uh-huh. kind of has a foot in both worlds. So I feel like maybe the door is open. We'll see what happens. He might just be an edge case. I don't know.
Well, you know, maybe there's just going to be more and more of us, you know. I'd like to think that I just kind of straddle both worlds a little mm-hmm. bit as a former professor. But I attended the esotericism conference at Colgate, and it was happening at the same weekend as a writing conference at Colgate. And I actually attended both conferences running back and forth.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Gosh, you probably needed like a week to recover after that.
Yeah. No kidding.
I love conferences, but they're draining too.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Well, we try to keep it to an hour, though. I think you and I could probably talk about writing and Sylvia Plath and everything for days and days. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of plug what's coming up. Like I said, this will air the beginning of July. And if you just have events or appearances or, you know.
Yeah. Well, so I'll probably have some more by the time this comes on. So I think the best thing to do is to visit my website, which is juliagordonbramer.com. And I'll spell that JULIAGORDON, B as in boy, RAM as in Mary, ER.com. And there's no hyphens or periods or anything. It just mm-hmm. all runs together. And so I'll keep my calendar up there. I am doing this summer, I'm doing like a 10-city tour. I actually just started it. I just returned from Nacogdoches, Texas, and they're probably going to have me back in the fall speaking at Stephen F. Austin State University, which is the school that published my first book, Decoding Sylvia Plath. So they've been super supportive of me. I just, you know, highest regards and shout out to that school. I'm hoping to get to some other schools. So, you know, if you have any professors or even students who want to rally for me, you know, have them reach out. They can find me through the website and we could maybe get something on the calendar. So, I'm working a lot of, festivals like, the Illuminate Festival, which is running along the East Coast. And it is a spiritual thing that'll be more my tarot stuff and less the Plath stuff, but the Plath stuff is always on my table too. And I'm always happy to talk.
Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, bookstores, festivals, campuses, I'm there if I can be. And if anybody wants me, please have them reach out.
Awesome. Oh, I was going to say one thing and I forgot, but I remembered while you were talking. that. So as I was reading the book, I read the poem for each chapter title before I read the chapter.
I
assume that you could not get rights to publish the poetry from estate.
Correct.
I know they're pretty, they keep that pretty close, the estate.
Yeah.
But I do recommend it for people reading the book. It really does kind of help understand what, why the chapter is important and what's going on. It was just a nice thing to do.
I didn't give it that much thought. You know, I selected good titles, you know, that were speaking for what the chapter was about, that, you know, that she had used for her poems. But I can't say that I really like aligned her poems very fully with the chapters or anything. So that's interesting that you found some.
It worked. Yeah. Meaning. No, it worked. So yeah, there you go. Great. A little tip for those who haven't read the book yet. Well, awesome. So our last question is a little bit of a game of chance. As a tarot reader, you'll know how that goes a little bit. So I'm going to roll a die. And the joke with this is, I don't know if you had an opportunity to listen to an episode, is that I always kind of lean into my Scorpio-ness, and which just means I don't know how to do small talk. So I always like to, you know, like ask people non-small talk questions when I meet them, which is an excuse to have a podcast. But so I'll roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. Those big, not small talk topics. And they are related to your work or your writing or something. I try not to completely left field people. And you can pass. And if I roll a six, you can pick which one you want.
Okay.
And you get a six. You get to pick.
Oh, goodness. So death, sex, politics, money.
Religion.
As they relate to my work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I'm a Sagittarian. So I have to, just for fun, I have to pick sex, right?
Okay. Okay, well, this one is more about tarot than Sylvia Plath. So I have only read publicly once as a reader for a charity event, because I don't consider myself a professional reader. But I do have an idea about this. I'm curious what you think. So as a tarot reader, what card comes up and you're immediately like, oh, there's some issues around sex, good or bad?
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, the obvious one, of course, is the Lovers, which is less about true love and more about passion and eroticism. And I do read reversals. So if it's in reverse, which is upside down, then that could be problematic there. But we could look at something else like the Nine of Swords, which, you know, I read as basically a card of repression, because if, you know, swords in the tarot are our thoughts, and all those swords are stacked on the wall behind her, and she's in this dark room and she's crying and she's turned away from her thoughts, you know? So she's not wanting to deal. She's not wanting to face things. She's repressing, she's denying. And so something like that might contribute if there's a problem. Then of course there can just be things like Two of Wands in reverse, distance, or Two of Cups in reverse, breakup. Or Two of Cups straight up, which might just be that they want to be friends more than lovers, you know, something like that. Yeah.
Interesting. So the imagery you're talking about there is from the Coleman Smith.
Yeah. You know, I always go back to the universal weight, rider weight based decks. To me, they're the best. I think it's there's a reason why they're the classic, and they just embody so much, like the way I described that Nine of Swords. I mean, you know, and I could have kept talking about it, you know, to say her world is fine. She's cozy in a bed. She even has a comforter, you know? So like all of these little exact details that tell a big story. And in my Tarot Life Lessons book, I have a story of a drunk guy who decided to take my cards and read for me. And he did a surprisingly good job just kind of riffing off the pictures, you know, because the pictures are that good.
Yeah.
And that's the deck I think everyone should learn on. And there's just so much wisdom built into that.
Yeah. It's funny you said that. The first time I ever really was around a deck of tarot cards was my freshman year in college. And the guy who had them didn't really read them. He would just tell stories with them. mm-hmm. would just start flipping cards out and just tell a story. And whatever the card was, that would change what he was talking about.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's fun. I know writers who use tarot that way. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to just let the deck tell them what direction a story's going or something like that. I mean, there's no one way to read. I think we all have our different way of doing it because we have our different gifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I do love the Coleman Smith artwork. I mean, I think I had to find a deck that wasn't the bright, like neon-y kind of colors because they distracted uh-huh. for me.
Yeah.
But there are some newer decks that have either gone back to like kind of more of the subtle tones that she actually used. And then I found this one called the Tea Stain Tarot that's just the black line Ooh. Drawings with like that kind of tea stained paper background that I really like.
Yeah. I think the problem with the classic is it's so white, you know, it's just Victorian England, you know, white.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't always relate to a lot of my clients. And so mm-hmm. I mix things up and I have other decks and, you know, there's many good decks today with all kinds of cultures. I've got the Light Seers Tarot on my table right now. And, you know, there's just a lot of them. And I like to do things like the Crow Tarot, which has no people at all, you know.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can go. It doesn't just have to be Victorian England to express us all
right.
anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting, especially when you talk about that with the way the cards look, the classic, you know, Rider-Waite-Smith deck and the way humanity looks. Yes, there is a disconnect, but the thoughts and the themes and all of that are universal.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And that's why it works for everyone. Mm-hmm. And tarot works for everyone. I mean, everyone has the mother figures, the father figures, the warrior, the elders, it's all there. You know, there's a card for everything.
Yeah.
Everyone can relate.
Yeah. Oh, Julia, thank you so much for this, for sharing your knowledge about Sylvia Plath and maybe the occult parts of her life.
Yeah.
And your tarot wisdom. And I hope that you find a home for your rock and roll memoir book.
I do too. Yeah. That's my next big project, I think.
Yeah. I think my next project is to go buy the PDF of your first Sylvia Plath book. So I didn't know that was available. I found out the book was out of print, but I didn't know you could still get the PDF. Yeah. So
I mention it every now and then on my website, but I'll have to do a better job of letting people know that I own the rights to it. I can sell it. You know,
yeah, so. That's awesome. Well, cool.
Yeah, maybe I'll get it reprinted. Who knows? But until then, got a PDF.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. And this was lovely.
Great to meet you, Victoria. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.